See, because here it goes through, you know, an essay form, and it goes through everything. But we're adjusting it so that it goes through and it explains very clearly the concept in each philosophy, what's God, what's the jiva, what's the material energy in the relationship, then what's their process of elevation, what's the result, so that it kind of shows it, so it makes it more clear. And it'll also have the, in Vedanta, it'll have the four sampradayas also. So it's been reorganized and a little bit expanded. His papers. Waiting for a...
He was talking with someone.
Oh, there he is.
One for each side or something.
One is his with not enough space on it. The other one is mine.
I'd actually put it in the back.
Yeah. You smell the
I'd look fine.
So right?
People
start another book? That's the idea?
Start another book.
For this course. So we want...
Yes, means book. Whatever is in here will be put into the one that's coming. Like that, because... Whatever's in here will go into the morning one. This is the study on its own. But now the idea is that this study can be expanded. Because otherwise the other book was going to take too much time. So, because you're having to explain it all it completely and explain it in the Jiva Dharma, but it's already been explained in Jiva Dharma, so any extra points then will just be brought in. So that way you shorten the scope. But in here we'll bring in also about, because it has the world religions and this and that, so we'll get into some detail. What makes the difference? More than just where the seeker is.
Hari Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Somebody's missing some pages. What does it start with?
Perception.
No, but I mean, does it have a number? Bottom?
12.
Anybody's only has up to 11?
What is it supposed to be up to?
We've got about 16.
Yeah. 16. But if you only have up to 11, then he has the other pages.
I think I'm good.
Everybody has? Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so the six systems of Vedic philosophy. Prabhupada mentions in the first canto that this is something that should be studied, because then you can actually understand the philosophy very nicely. Because you know the dasamul, so you know what's the correct, and you also then know how the others take that and misapply it. Right? So that means you know what's proper and what's improper. So with that, then it creates...
Is it improper?
This is very pleasant, nice, improper.
The last one here is proper?
Vedanta is, but it also has the improper.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? In other words, sometimes the six systems are called six systems, meaning they're all bogus. That's if you're counting Vedanta as Shankara.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But Vedanta includes all, there. So sometimes then also the Vedanta is called the six systems. Because you have the four sampradayas, you have the Gaudiyas, and you have Shankara.
Okay.
So that way also. So sometimes people talk about the six. They're meaning only in Vedanta.
Mm.
But it means, the Saddarshan means the six. Because these are all based on the Veda. So in that way, they're correct that they have a proper understanding that the Veda is authority. Unfortunately, their conclusions aren't complete.
Mm-hmm.
They only take it to a certain degree, certain level. So that's the problem. Okay, so here we have the introduction. Nyaya, the philosophy of logic and reasoning. Vaisheshika, Vedic atomic theory. Shankhya, non-theistic dualism. Yoga, self-discipline for self-realization. Karma Mimamsa, elevation through the performance of duty. And Vedanta, the conclusion of the Vedic revelation. Okay, so introduction. The word Veda means knowledge. In the modern world, we use the term science to identify the kind of authoritative knowledge upon which human progress is based. Right, because they just take knowledge as just anything. But here, knowledge means what's the scientific basis.
Mm.
Like that. So here's already a difference between the proper Vedic and, you know, modern usage. To ancient people of the Bharat Varsha, Greater India, the word Veda had an even more profound import that the word science has for us today. That is because in those days, scientific inquiry was not restricted to the world perceived by the physical senses. And the definition of human progress was not restricted to massive technological exploitation of material nature. Right? Because you're limiting. Because if you can see it with the senses, you can measure it that way, then it limits all your sciences. Right? So what about the mind, the intelligence, the consciousness? These things are completely left out, and they're much greater sciences.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? What you see is one thing. What you do with what you see is more important. Right? That's what's left out. And also then, if your only purpose is going to be fruitive results, then that also limits what you can get from it. So that means the concept of knowledge is very, very narrow in the modern context. In Vedic times, the primary focus of science was the eternal, not the temporary. Human progress meant the advancement of spiritual awareness, yielding the soul's release from the entrapment of material nature, which is temporary and full of ignorance and suffering. So that means all the Vedic ones had the idea of becoming released from suffering. Though we see karma mimamsa is that you're going to be elevated and always enjoy the material energy, but they are taking into consideration karma, the transmigration of the soul. And everything has to be based upon the Shastra. Right? Yes.
And even Day Maharaj, later they developed the idea of liberation. So they also fell in line with the line of thought of other six schools. The goal of life is liberation, not just enjoyment in heaven.
Oh, okay, yes.
So
yeah. Okay, good time. Vedic footnote 1. Therefore, the Indian and Western philosophies are based on opposing premises. Quote, the Indian thinkers offer the fruit of their speculations with certain presuppositions, a clear statement of which is necessary, therefore, for their right appraisal. But in this respect, they may be compared to their counterparts in the West, where it is held that, one, man cannot know metaphysical truths by direct experience, or two, even granting that someday they may be known, so far no man has known them, and three, therefore, being
pure speculations, the various schools of Indian philosophy, like the speculative systems of the West, must be mutually contradictory, and that if one is true, all the rest must be false. Now the presuppositions of the Indian thinkers are, 1, man can know metaphysical truths directly. 2, there have been such men, and there may still be rishis or seers. 3, the rishis teach metaphysical truths after knowing them directly. 4, while all the rishis know the same truths, just as all men of sight see the same sun, they teach these truths in different standards represented by the texts of the schools.
Okay, see, the first one is very muddled and difficult, and the second one is much more clear, even though they dealt with the same points, because there's a consistency. Because the other one is, you can only know what's done by the senses, you can't know the metaphysical. Even if someone does, you know, maybe in the future, but now we don't. So because of that, then there's going to be every school is going to be different than the other. But here is that these metaphysical truths can be understood. They're coming from the scripture. Therefore, there's a consistency. Right? It's just a matter of that their standards, the words they're using, or how far they're taking you on the same path. Right? The Western is like they're completely separate paths. But the Indian is that it's one path, but it's just how far you're getting on it. Right? Not necessarily that they all acknowledge that they're only getting so far, but you know, but there's the common ground like that. Either they think farther than that's not worthwhile, you know, or the others haven't gone far enough. Yes.
So Maharaj, for the Indian thought means there is always some realization is there.
Yes, realization is there. Because the other is only knowledge. They're only trying to get gyan, but the Vedic is always vigyan. Yes.
Could we also say that the Western is a philosophy of ignorance in that it always ends with we don't know?
Yes, as we don't know, but for some people, a bunch of people don't know, then they're quite good at giving awards and doing all kinds of things with it and being very proud of what they don't know. We are extremely, you know, confident of what we don't know. We know we don't know. And the one who's the most confident in not knowing, then he gets a degree, yes. Vedic knowledge is called aparosheya, which means it is not knowledge of human invention. Vedic knowledge appeared at the dawn of the cosmos within the heart of Brahma, the lotus-born demigod of creation, from whom all the species of life within the universe descend. Brahma imparted this knowledge in the form of shabda, spiritual sound, to his immediate sons, who are the great sages of higher planetary systems like Satyaloka, Janaloka, and Kapaloka. These sages transmitted the Vedic Shabda to disciples all over the universe, including wise men of earth in ancient times. 5,000 years ago, the great Vedic authority, Krishna Dwaipayana Vyas, compiled the Shabda into Sanskrit scripture, Shastra, which collectively is known today as the Vedas. In the India of old, the study of the Vedas was the special prerogative of the Brahmanas, the priestly and intellectual class. There are 4 degrees of education in Vedic knowledge that corresponded to the 4 ashrams of Brahminical culture: the Brahmachari or student ashram, the Grihastha or household ashram, the Vanaprastha retired ashram, and the Sannyasa or renounced ashram. The first degree of learning was the memorization of the Vedic Samhita, which consisted of 20,000 mantras divided into 4 sections, Rig, Sama, Yajur, and Atharva, that are chanted by priests in glorification of various aspects of the Supreme Being during sacrificial rituals. So 20,000 means all the 4 Vedas. Because Rig is about 10, then Yajur's, it may even be more. Yajur's about 8, Atharva's about 5 or 6, and Sama's about a little over 1,000.
It's 25,000.
Yeah.
Becomes
almost 25. Yeah. So okay, the second degree was the mastery of the Brahmana portion of the Vedas, which teaches rituals for fulfillment of duties to family, society, demigods, sages, other living entities, and the Supreme Lord. Right. So the Brahmacharis memorize the texts. Right. Then they get married, and then they study the Brahmanas to how they're going to apply this in ritual. Right, the performance of family duties, all these different things like that.
The third degree was the mastery of the Aranyaka portion, which prepares the retired householder for complete renunciation. Aranyaka is the metaphysics and what's going on in the sacrifice. So the focus won't be on the ritual to get the fruit of result, but will be more on what's the metaphysical. Mm-hmm. You know, so what's the element, how to renounce, how to go above the physical platform. The fourth degree was the mastery of the Upanishads, which present the philosophy of the absolute truth to persons seeking liberation from birth and death. Right? So that's Vedanta. So we see our philosophy is focused on this. So all the devotees, whether they're brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas, they study the Upanishad section. Right? Because that's the section where we're trying to understand the absolute truth. Right? Does that make sense? So that portion is called Vedanta, the end of Veda. So that's the Upanishads, right? Vedanta Sutra is giving the essence of that. Bhagavatam is a natural commentary on that. Does that make sense? So that's our sphere. The text study in the four stages of formal Vedic education are collectively called Shruti Shastra, scripture that is to be heard by the Brahmanas. But Shruti Shastra is not all there is to the Vedic literature. Chandogya Upanishad 7.1.2 declares that the Puranas and Itihasas comprise the fifth division of the Vedic study. The Puranas and Itihas teach the same knowledge as the four Vedas, but is illustrated with extensive historical narrations. The fifth Veda is known as Smriti Shastra, scripture that must be remembered. Smriti Shastra study was permitted to non-Brahmins. It means anybody can study that. Otherwise, the others, you had to hear it from Brahmins, and so you had to be qualified yourself. Right, so that would be the Brahminical. As Vaishnavas, then one is qualified because one has the Brahminical, qualification of wanting to know Brahman. So that means anybody can be. But the point is it's the Puranas and Itihasas that are what is of interest. Right, because the actual essence of all the Vedas is given in the Bhagavad, and that's a Purana. So for us, the Smriti is actually more important. But it's all based on Shruti. It's all based on the Veda. Traditionally, six schools of thought. Does that make sense? So because to the other ones, to learn them, to practice them, unless one basically lived the Brahminical lifestyle. And if you weren't a devotee, the only ones that would live a Brahminical lifestyle to that degree would be those who are practicing Brahmins. Does that make sense? So then they were qualified to study, you know, as a lifestyle. But otherwise, the Kshatriyas and the Vaishyas also would study. But they wouldn't. It would not be their occupation, right? It would be part of their personal development. Traditionally, six schools of thought propagated Vedic wisdom, each from a different philosophical perspective. Each of these perspectives, or darshans, is associated with a famous sage who is the author of a sutra, code, expressing the essence of his darshan. Vyasa's Vedanta Sutra, which carefully examines and judges the six systems of Vedic philosophy, as well as other philosophies, forms the third great body of Vedic literature after the Shruti Shastra and Smriti. This is known as Nyaya Shastra, the scripture of philosophical disputation. Right, so you get Shruti, Smriti, and Nyaya. These three, I think they're called, what is this one?
Prastantraya.
Yeah, Prastantraya means the three authorities, the three pramanas, like that. The Saddarshana, six philosophical views, are Nyaya, logic, Vaisheshika, atomic theory, Shankhya, analysis of matter and spirit, Yoga, the discipline of self-realization, Karma, Mimamsa, science of fruit and work, and Vedanta, science of God-realization. The Saddarshans are termed Astika philosophies, from Asti, or it is so, because they all acknowledge the Vedas as authoritative, as opposed to the Gnostic philosophies of the Charvaks, Buddhists, and Jains. Nasti, it is not so, means Astika, means Astik, it is so, or Na-Astik, it is not so. Right, because that's their whole point. Mm-hmm. Buddhists, there's nothing. The Jains, it may be, it may not be. You know, that's their point. You know? Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, how do you know? Maybe it's not. You know, so it's like, you know, so then, oh yeah, okay. So that's what keeps them busy. Right? You need something to keep them off the streets, so like that. So this is what they do. Charvakas, that we'll see as we go. But they're the ones who eat, sleep, and be merry, because tomorrow you may die, right? You know, so. No, basically. Right, very popular during the plague, right?
Specifically,
ghee. Yeah, well, that was. Maybe that's why they. Yeah, you don't hear of the plague in India, maybe because they were using ghee, but they didn't use ghee. So. Beginning with Nyaya. Each of the Sadarshans in their own turn presents a more developed and comprehensive explanation of the aspects of Vedic knowledge. So Nyaya is in this order it's studied because this is the order of how much they're developed. Nyaya is very exact but very simple. Then Vaisheshika expands on that. Then Shankhya, then Patanjali, then like this, it gets bigger and bigger till Vedanta covers them all. Right? Does that make sense? So Nyaya is used, we have to, just to be clear, Nyaya is a system of logic. But Gotama used it as his process of self-realization. Yes?
Sorry, Lord Chaitanya used this system when he was discussing philosophy?
The system?
Of logic?
That's what we're explaining now.
No, Lord Chaitanya was using this system.
Which system?
When he was having discussions with
No, but when you say this system, which one do you mean? Because I was about to explain
Nyaya,
two of them.
Nyaya,
he
was using that system?
Nyaya. Nyaya means logic.
Yeah, he was using that type of system.
Means everybody uses it.
Okay.
See, the point is Nyaya is a system of philosophy, is a system of logic. Gotama uses it as a system of philosophy. So we shouldn't get it confused. It's just like, let's say you have music, right? But then someone uses it as their philosophy of how to understand God through this note, then there's this and that note. You know, it's stretching it. It doesn't quite work. So therefore, Nyaya as the process of logic and Nyaya as the philosophy, then though they're technically using the same thing, but it's not meant to be used as a philosophy. It's meant to be to explain philosophy.
It's a tool.
Yes, it's only a tool. Nyaya sets up the rules of philosophical debate and identifies the basic subjects under discussion. The physical world, the soul, God, and liberation. Right, so the definitions of Nyaya everybody uses. It's just standard, like that. How they're defined, that's just standard discussion, like that. You have this one step. Yeah, I don't even remember. But it's this one book. It gives 100 definitions in it. Simple book. It's considered the basis. Everybody learns that when they first start Nyaya, like that. So we see Bhagavatam, they all define, means what is the soul, what is God, what's the material world. So this is what Nyaya does. Then you're very clear. So when you say this word, this is what you mean. Right? Because otherwise, without this, then you may find yourself having a discussion with somebody, and you're arguing over it, and hours later, then if you have the tolerance and all that, and the time, then you find out you're both saying exactly the same thing, but you're using different terminology. So you just wasted hours because of terminology. So that's the idea of Nyaya. There's no waste of time. Because as soon as you say the word, the discussion starts, rather than trying to figure out what each other's trying to say. Okay. So physical world, the soul, God, and liberation. Right? So it's same. Sambandhigyan. Right? Physical world, the soul, God. But the problem is liberation, that's as far as it goes. That's where its weakness is. And its process will be very seen as difficult. Vaisheshika engages the method of Nyaya, or logic, in a deeper analysis of the predicament of material existence by showing that the visible material forms to which we are all so attached ultimately break down into invisible atoms. Right? He's just taking it, okay, I'm not this rock. Okay, I'm not the pillar, I'm not this, you know, table, like this. And so then eventually by logic you go through and we're not any of these different things. Right? But it's just what you see. Vaisheshika takes it even that you think it's a pillar, but actually it's just a bunch of atoms. So it's indivisible. Those are just a grouping of these unlimited manifestations of earth atoms. But this is just together, so if you think you're absorbed in it like this, but actually it's just a group of those atoms. Right? So then you break it down to even more that there isn't anything here worthwhile. So it makes it just so much easier for liberation. Does that make sense? Shankya develops the analytical process further to help the soul become aloof to matter. Then he shows how one transforms and the other, how the mechanics are all going on. These first two don't get into the mechanics of how the world really works. It's just the facts of this, what it is. Yes.
For example, those who follow Shankya, do they accept that the Nyaya and Vaisheshika are their basis, so they expand from that?
Basically. But the point is they wouldn't have a problem with that because they're in the superior position.
And those Vaisheshika,
they might have a problem with that, you know. But the point is because it's not so developed, someone from Shankya can always defeat them. You know? Does that make sense? So that's why, even for ourselves, we'll use, means each one has their arguments that are very exact in a certain area. And so everybody uses those. Means the higher you up you are, you use all those at the lower one. Why would you make up something new? It already works good. You know? So, that, like even when Krishna was defeating the whole point of the demigods, right? Then he used Karma Mimamsa, you know, which is the fifth one. So it's just one down below. So then after that, then you defeat that with Vedanta. Otherwise, we'll blip again. I wish we was a happy person.
The other question is that those who developed Shankya, they did it purposely to develop the other two because
it was not sufficient. Not unless maybe
like
it can be like that, but I think it's more of just there's different sages.
Next section
will deal with this.
Okay. She's good at those questions.
Yes. And then the next sentence is the yeah.
Sorry,
you
didn't have material.
No, it's okay. Though yoga, the soul awakens in its intimate, innate spiritual vision to see itself beyond the body. Karma, Mimamsa, directs the soul to the goals of Vedic ritualism. Vedanta focuses on the supreme spiritual goal taught in the Upanishads. Originally, the six darshans were departments of study in a unified understanding of the Veda, comparable to the faculties of a modern university. But with the onset of Kali Yuga, the age of quarrel, the scholars of the darshans became divided and contentious. Some even misrepresented Vedic philosophy for their own selfish ends. For instance, Karma Mimamsa, which by 500 BC had become the foremost philosophy of the Brahmana class, was misused by bloodthirsty priests to justify their mass slaughter of animals in Vedic sacrifices. But the unexpected rise of a novel non-Vedic religion challenged the power of Karma Mimamsa. This new religion was Buddhism. By 250 BC, the influence of Karma Mimamsa and other darshans had weakened considerably. When King Ashoka instituted the Buddha doctrine as the state philosophy of his empire, many brahmanas abandoned Vedic scholarship to learn and teach Gnostic concepts of ahimsa, non-violence, and shunyata, voidism. Right? So there are all different aspects, like we were mentioning before, is that the Nyaya was the system of logic. It means your Vaisheshika is that you're looking at how everything comes down to the atoms. Because anima is the indivisible portion. So if you can divide it, it's not down to atoms. So that means it'll go back to that. So in your pradhan and your mahatattva, you're dealing just with atoms. But as soon as there's manifestation, means you're grouping these atoms together and getting all the different forms. So that's just how it, you know. But it's not as developed as Shankya that will show exactly what modes, what things are making all these different manifestations work. Right? Does that make sense? So they're all there, you know, how to meditate, how to perform your rituals. But they're all ultimately meant for understanding the Vaishnava philosophy, which is Vedanta. But with time, we see that these different schools become... they try to establish on their own. So that's the difficulty. They should be one system, but they're not.
Could this be considered like a parallel to the way we have a tendency to get attached to the Naishtika Dharma, the form of things? If you're using Nyaya, it's actually a tool, but you get attached to the Nyaya.
You get attached to the tool, yeah. So you like the logic, you like the different things, you like playing with it. So then you get distracted. So it becomes a goal rather than just a means.
I heard that during this time that they were using the Karamimans to slaughter animals, the Brahmins used to say that if you don't slaughter, you're in Maya.
Could be. It means, in other words, if there's something that you are doing that's not, you know, it could be interpreted in a few ways, then you'll always say that yours is the main, just to make sure. But that's why the devotional process is going to, you know, great lengths to point out that it's not the ritual that makes the devotion. It's using the ritual to please the Lord. So the point is how is the animal sacrifice pleasing to the Lord as a person? You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You're performing the rules according to the ritual. Like that. So everything's correct there, but how does it please the Lord as a person? So that's where the weakness comes in. So.
The students of the Rasa, they already are gone through these the initial five things, or they need not have.
No, if you study Vedanta Sutra, that's what it deals with. It deals with all these schools, means all these the six Vedic schools, and it deals with the non-Vedic schools. So it already deals with all of these sections. So it's in other words, what we're doing now in this third year is a, you could say, a, there's fancy words for it, but basically an in-depth overview, like that, detailed overview or something. They have nice names for it in the educational circles. But basically it means we're getting familiar with these six schools, which basically will be a lot more than most anybody will know. But it's so that we're comfortable to work with and apply what we're learning, right? But then when we're studying on the last six chapters of Gita, at that time then we'll study the Vedanta Sutra. So that will be a more in-depth study. But it'll also be a little bit longer than this, not much longer. But the amount that you'll be experienced in the philosophy is so much that that shorter study you'll get so much more depth. Because now we're just trying to figure out what it is. By then it's like you know what it is, and then what are the fine points on it. Like that. Does that make sense? Yeah. Plus it'll be studied in connection with Bhagavatam. Well, here. Yeah. Buddhism, in its turns, was eclipsed by the teachings of the Vedantist Shankara, who revived the Vedic culture all over India in the 7th century after Christ. But Shankara's special formulation of Vedanta was itself influenced by Buddhism. It is not truly representative of the original Vedanta Darshan taught by Vyas. The last chapter will take this up in greater detail. So in other words, there were all these different philosophies that are going around, different varieties of impersonalism and this and that. So he used the Shastric basis of that to establish his darshan. But actually the philosophy wasn't true impersonalism, right? The Vedic impersonal, it was actually Buddhism. So that's why probably uses the term covered Buddhism. It was Buddhism covered by, using Vedic Shastric evidence to establish it. But it's not actually real impersonal philosophy. Mm. Otherwise, they wouldn't say everything's Maya. Because if everything's Brahman, it means it's all Brahman, it's real. You know. But it's just, there's no interest of any fruitive result from it. That's the difference. Right? In other words, the impersonalist, the Brahmavadi, it's all Brahman, and so there's no material gain to get from it. So there's no material endeavor.
right? But it all exists, right? So that means they can have the material energy, right, but not have any interest in gaining anything from it. Right? Therefore, Sukadeva Goswami just wanders around. There's nothing to gain. But at the same time, he can tell the difference between a tree and the road. That's why he doesn't bump into any. Right? So, but the Mayavadi, because you can't enjoy the material energy, they say it's illusion, it doesn't exist. Right? So it's actually more akin to Buddhism, which is frustration of not being able to get what you want. Does that make sense? So it's not actually very, very mature. But, and if you have people who've been practicing Buddhism for, you know, some time, then it works good. It works good for them. Like that.
They practiced Buddhism in India actually for more than 900 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they left.
Yeah, Ashok, well, it's not exactly they left. They were inspired to leave.
They were kicked out.
Yes, they were kicked out. But he only went up to the borders of India. And then after that, he stopped. That's why the rest of Asia remained Buddhist. Like that. So, because Ashok, then he established it as the national religion. So then Buddhism got very well established, and then also beyond India at that time. But then that same endeavor wasn't there. It was only in India it was stopped. So everybody else just continued with it. After Shankara, the Vedanta was refined by the schools of great teachers, acharyas like Ramanuja and Madhva. Having shed the baggage of Shankara's crypto-Buddhism, Vedanta philosophers soared to heights of dialectical sophistication that has been much appreciated by many Western intellectuals. Crypto-Buddhism. Okay, that's interesting.
Okay. So we can say that there is no actual impersonals in those schools? If this is crypto-Buddhism.
I mean, Shankara's is this crypto-Buddhism.
So if Shankara is considered to be the impersonalist, the acharya of the impersonalist, so meaning there's no impersonalist then?
There are schools, those will be dealt with, but all it is that they're understanding the supreme Lord, but they're not complete. They only understand the Brahman aspect. They don't know Paramatma and Bhagavan.
The Brahman bodies?
Yeah, the Brahman bodies. So it means, in other words, what we do means you have a Dvaitavad, right? So that's one of the Vedantic conclusions you can come to. So you can say Shankara is a branch of that, though actually shastrically nicely representing, but actually philosophically not representing at all. It's actually Buddhism. Does that make sense? So Shankara is taken as the main one because he's the one that comments and everybody knows him. People don't know the others and, you know, the philosophy really. But Vyasadeva deals with it. Like that. So. It is through the dialectics of the major schools, Sampradayas of Vedanta, that students can best observe the six systems of Vedic philosophy in action. In dialectical Vedanta, arguments are taken from Nyaya, Vaisheshika, etc. 2, 1, demonstrate that Vedanta is the most comprehensive of all the darshans, and 2, to clarify the points of controversy that arise between the different schools of Vedanta itself. Vedantic dialectics are represented in the Bhashyas, commentaries of the Acharyas, and Tikas, sub-commentaries of their disciples. All possible philosophical positions, including some bearing remarkable resemblance to the ideas of European philosophers, are therein proposed, analyzed, and refuted. A footnote 2. Srimad Bhagavatam is a natural commentation on the Brahma Sutra, or the Bhadarayani Vedanta Sutras. It is called natural because Vyasadeva is author of both the Vedanta Sutras and Srimad Bhagavatam, or the essence of all Vedic literatures. Besides Vyasadeva, there are other sages who are the authors of six different philosophical systems, namely Gautama, Kanada, Kapila, Patanjali, Jaimini, and Astavakra. Theism is explained completely in the Vedanta Sutra, whereas in the other systems of philosophical speculations, practically no mention is given to the ultimate cause of all causes. Yet practically no mention. They understand the Supreme is there, but they don't really mention it. Just like Patanjali will talk, I've heard in the second chapter, he'll talk a lot about Paramatma and being, you know, Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, all that. And so you know who you're meditating on. But when he gets to the last chapters, or one's absorbed in samadhi, he doesn't really refer anymore about his position as the Supreme Lord. Just, you know, you're just the meditation, the techniques of meditation. So then it kind of gets lost. That ultimate position gets lost.
Those sages, they are so advanced in knowledge, they couldn't see those gaps in their seals.
Means you have, see, there's two elements. Is that, as we were saying before, is that the different Vedic literatures, in other words, the Smriti, then is discussions by great personalities on the one topic matter of the Supreme Lord. But because they're presenting it through the opera medium, they use the particular terminology that works best for explaining the presentation in line with the particular material phenomena that they're comparing it with. Does that make sense? Right? So the difficulty comes up is that in the philosophy it's the same. It means they're presenting, but from these different angles. Because all it is that particular aspect of the philosophy, they've gone into great depth. And so they've explained that. But problem is then some will take it that is the major, rather than that's a supportive part, but just a great detail. You know what I'm saying? Just like we say we're not the body. So if someone takes the element of the not we're body and expands it out into a whole book of different ways to understanding and real detail and all that. So then the problem is others who are attracted by that presentation then may take it that's actually the most important element, rather than we're servant of Krishna. So then that part gets lost, and then they just get into the, you know, what do you call it? Asharirabads. Right? But does that make sense? Yeah. One can sit on the Vyasasan only after being conversant in all systems of philosophy, so one can present fully the theistic views of the Bhagavatam in defiance of all other systems. Srimad Bhagavatam 117 purport. So that's what we were talking about. So this is where Prabhupada is recommending this study. So it's because of this verse, therefore, this study is here. Because otherwise, people bring up all these different things and one doesn't know that they're... You know, like last year when we analyzed in the Gita, there's so many times devotees will bring up seemingly a natural step in a basic philosophical point that they know about, but the direction they take it is actually not within Vedanta. They take it out into some other philosophy. You know, generally Maya, though sometimes Buddhism, right? Because those are the two popular Western, Nirvishesha and Shunyavad. So they don't even know they're doing it. So that's the idea, is that if you understand the systems, then you can catch where that happens. The study of the six systems of Vedanta philosophy is itself a form of yoga, jnana yoga, the yoga of theoretical knowledge. But from jnana one must come to vijnana, practical realization of the ultimate truth. The six darshans are six branches of theoretical dialectics, shastarta, that twist and turn from thesis, purvapaksha, to antithesis, uttarpaksha, to synthesis, siddhanta, like the gnarled branches of a tree. But the ways of philosophical disputation do not themselves add up to the absolute truth. Right? Just because you're discussing the philosophy, doesn't mean that you've actually attained the absolute truth. Right? Siddhanta must be coming down in parampara. So it's not the argumentation that makes the absolute truth. It's trying to understand and establish the absolute truth over misunderstandings. Right? That's the usefulness. So that, therefore it appears that the Vaishnavas are using also all these dialectics. But the point is they're only doing that to establish the proper Siddhanta. Right? It's not that by arguing, that's how you come to understand the absolute truth. The absolute truth, being transcendental, is only indirectly framed in the branches of jnana. Like this rising full moon may be framed by the branches of a tree. A friend who wishes to see the moon may first draw our attention to that tree. Oh, who wishes us to see the moon may first draw our attention to that tree. This may be compared to the indirect or theoretical stage of knowledge. Seeing the moon is the vijnana. So then, this is a Vishwanath uses as an example, but I think it's a Upanishadic like example.
It's well known.
So yeah, well known. So the idea is that the theoretical, all these understanding this is just so that it brings one near the absolute truth. Does that make sense? There is a straightforward path to vijnana. It is explained in the Mahabharata, Dvanaparva, 313-117. Dry arguments are inconclusive. Philosophers are known for their differences of opinion. Study of the branches of the Vedas will not bring one to the correct understanding of Dharma. The truth is hidden in the heart of the self-realized person. Therefore, one should follow the path of such great souls. So in other words, just studying oneself, arguing over these things, that's not what's going to actually give realization. It's following in the footsteps of the realized souls. Right? So that was what was that Vaishnava Das was making the points. By association with Vaishnavas, taking what they're speaking, seeing their example, applying that in your life, that's what's actually going to make it work. Right? That's what's dynamic. So it always comes back to the same point. It's useful, you know, but one has to know its place. The Sanskrit word acharya is derived from achar, behavior. The great teachers of Vedanta, the acharyas, were much more than just theoreticians. By their exemplary God-conscious behavior, they marked out the path of practical transcendental realization. This is the path from jnana to vijnana. In India, the sampradayas, schools of Vedanta, established by the great acharyas, are bastions of sadachar, spiritual life. Sadachar means achar is behavior. Sadachar means eternal behavior. In other words, devotional behavior. Sadachar is the, devotional activities. Students who enter these schools cultivate divine qualities, cleanliness, austerity, truthfulness, and mercy, without which divine knowledge cannot manifest. Cleanliness is destroyed by illicit sex. Austerity is destroyed by intoxication. Truthfulness is destroyed by gambling. Mercy is destroyed by meat eating. Okay. One who cannot restrain himself from these bad habits has no business calling himself a Vedantist or a yogi. There is much enthusiasm today for theoretical yoga and mysticism, but until one follows the path of sadachar set down by the acharyas, one's inquiry into Indian spirituality will be like licking the glass of a sealed jar of honey. The higher taste, param drishva, will be missed. The Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya first introduced genuine Vedanta theory and practice in the Western world in 1966. When Acharya Sri Srimad A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada opened the first branch of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, ISKCON, in New York. ISKCON now has centers around worldwide. This work is but an introduction to Vedanta philosophy. Those who wish to practice this philosophy and realize the goal of Vedanta, the form of the Supreme Eternal Being, should contact ISKCON. Okay. So this is the introduction as it was. Basically, yes. Okay, common features of the six systems of Vedic philosophy. It has already been explained that the Sat Darshana accept the authority of the Vedas. and thus they are classified as Astika philosophies. Each darshana is codified by a great Vedic sage, Nyaya by Gotama, Vaisheshika by Kanada, Shankya by Kapila, Yoga by Patanjali, Karma Mimamsa by Jaimini, and Vedanta by Vyas. Because the sages drew their arguments from the same source, the Vedic Shastra, the darshans share many of the same basic philosophical principles. For instance, the self is understood to be an individual spiritual being of the nature of eternal consciousness. The self acquires a succession of physical bodies through reincarnation. Under the law of karma, the self suffers because of its contact with matter, and the end of suffering is the goal of philosophy. A person who adheres to any one of the six systems observes the same sadhana as the followers of the other systems. Sadhana consists of the basic practices of purification and self-control. It is a foundation of Brahminical culture. So, in other words, the culture is the same. The practice is the same. There'll be a difference in the philosophical viewpoint, you know, what their goal is and that. But the practice will be the same, because they're based on the same scriptures. Does that make sense? So all of them accept the soul, the eternality of the soul, that the soul is reincarnation, is going through all these different bodies, and that by doing that, he's entangled, that's why he suffers. So getting rid of this suffering, that's the goal of the philosopher. Right? Does that make sense? So then, with this, then, five of them, you get you beyond the material world, and karma just leaves you here, you're beyond suffering because you're always doing good work, so therefore you'll always enjoy. Right? Only slight problem is the every action is covered by fault, so you will do a few things that aren't exactly right, so you will suffer anyway. Right? So that's the weakness there. Okay, now Nyaya, the philosophy of logic and reasoning. The Nyaya system of philosophy was established by the sage Gotama, as he was also known as Akshapada. This system is also sometimes referred to as the Akshapada system. Right. He was known as... You explain it, Akshapada? Or?
He doesn't.
He does. So Akshapada means he has eyes on his feet. Aksha means eyes, and pada is feet. Because Gotama was so absorbed in studying that he'd walk around with a book in his hand. And one day while I was walking around, he fell in this ditch. And I guess the demigods were pleased with his devotion to the study, so they blessed him with eyes on his feet. So that way he can walk around with the book studying, but the eyes on his feet, then they can tell where to go, and so he doesn't fall into any ditches. Like that.
Practical.
Yeah. But that would definitely mean you would not be able to wear Western shoes. Unless you had a hole. There,
Crocs.
Crocs. You'd just put a bigger hole. Like here. The word Nyaya properly signifies right or justice. Technically, the word Nyaya signifies a syllogism. Nyaya philosophy is primarily concerned with the conditions of correct knowledge and the means of receiving this knowledge. It means what is actually correct and what's not. Because you can make a statement, but is the statement actually correct? Mm. That's why everybody uses the system. Mm-hmm. Because someone can say something, but as we will see as we go through, it's not necessarily that what they say has a basis. Most of the time when we're arguing, what we'll say actually doesn't have anything to do with what we're discussing, and it definitely doesn't even have a basis. But because of the emotions and people's involvement in it, therefore they keep going in it and don't worry about that. Nyaya is predominantly based on reasoning and logic and is therefore known as Nyaya Vidhi, or Tarka Shastra, the science of logic and reasoning. Like Tarka means, you know, arguments. That. Because this system analyzes the nature and source of knowledge and its validity and non-validity, it is also referred as Anvikshiki, which means the study of the science of critical study. Right? But we'll say Anvikshiki, you know, means when it's applied with proper philosophy. So if you take Vedanta and Nyaya, That's andikshiki. Mm. Is then you're studying how to understand something through the Vedantic perspective. Mm. But because he's using his nyaya as a philosophy, as a mimamsa, therefore then you could technically call it andikshiki. Mm. So it's not actually an appropriate application. Because the logic is correct, the philosophy is wanting. It is also called Pramana Shastra, or the science of logic and epistemology. It means what you're saying, the words that you're using, do they actually have meaning? You know, the basis of what you're saying, do they actually have logic? Using systematic reasoning, this school of philosophy attempts to discriminate valid knowledge from invalid knowledge. So they'll define what is the ways you can get knowledge, and which ones actually are part of something else, which ones don't even work. So all this, he'll get it right into that. Because otherwise we take it for granted that if it falls out of someone's mouth, it must be of value. You know, specifically it's our mouth. You know, of course, there's that. Others, then, of course, there's differences.
To the extent that they agreed with me.
Yeah. You know, like, what is it? That one of the sutras, I think it's Madhva's, the differences are real. Like that. The differences are real. It means I've said something, someone else is difference. That's real, you know, and that's the real difference. You know. Sambandha, the concept of God. Because we'll go through now Sambandha, what is God, what is the living entities, and what is the material energy. Mm. Right? Because we're using the book that you showed before, the Six Systems, has been reorganized so that it's in this order. So it makes it very clear. Otherwise, each section kind of has its own presentation in the book, so sometimes it's hard to compare them. So this has been made so that it's all like this. So concept of God, so we can see what's the concept of God in one and in the other, and they can compare like that. Plus, it'll also make it more clear where it's its strengths and weaknesses. You know, how far it actually has some understanding, and then where it falls short. According to Nyaya, God is considered to be the operative cause of creation, maintenance, and destruction of the universe. Right? So they accept God, right? But we'll see is that there's no devotion to God. God does not create the world out of nothing or out of himself, but rather out of eternal atoms of space, time, mind, and soul. Right? So there's a weakness, nor out of himself. Means not out of himself as the personality, but out of his potencies. But that's not clear. You understand? So therefore it seems like there's a differentiation. So this can give rise to people thinking that, you know, God's one thing and the material world's another. The creation of the universe refers to the ordering of these eternal entities, which are in coexistence with God into a mortal world. So in other words, these entities are there, and then they're created into something that we can see. Right? Is that? So atoms of space, time, mind, and soul. Right? So then that's all put together, and then you have what's your world here. Thus, God, as the first operative cause of the universal forces, is a creator of the world. Right? So he's the first operative cause, and so therefore he's the original cause. So then in that system of logic, then that works, yes.
How he drew it from the Vedas, he takes one sutra, for example, and then he gives his own explanation?
Yes, that's what mimamsa means. Mimamsa is how you interpret the words of the Veda. So they'll have a particular perspective. So whenever this word comes up, it means this, or that, or this concept, it means like this.
Because like this, it's not from himself.
He'll be basing it on the Vedic. But the problem is he'll take it and emphasize one area. Just like means, yes, it's overemphasized. Just like we say, the universe is non-different from God, but it's different from God. So they'll just overemphasize that it's different. And somehow or another, it's the same gets lost. Does that make sense? Yeah. Thus, God... Okay. So footnote 3. Still, Nyaya does not accept God as the material cause of the world. The Nyaya concept of God as being the efficient but not the material cause of the world has an obvious reference to human analogy and reduces God to a position of a human artificer who makes things out of given material. And okay. On the other hand, the Vedanta philosophy accepts that God is the material, formal, efficient, and final cause of the world. Right? These four causes proposed by Aristotle is defined as follows. Something created must have substance. The substance of the material or ingredient cause. Something created must have shape. That shape is the formal cause. Creating something is an act, and that act must be initiated. That which initiates creation is the efficient cause. Something created must have a purpose. That purpose is the final cause. Any realistic plan of creation must account for all these four causes. For instance, to create a house, there must be materials, an architectural design, a skilled construction crew, and a purpose that makes the building of the house worth the time and the money. That the Lord is himself, the four causes proposed by Aristotle is indicated in Srimad Bhagavatam 6.9.42. Right? So here also we see is that you're taking it that you have those four like this, but at the same time as you have what's beyond. So Aristotle, because he was basically, you could say, a materialist, he wasn't much into the metaphysic because it didn't really work out for his, how you say, you know, yes, his param guru, like that. So his guru basically kind of finessed it, but he just completely outright just ignored it. You know, all the metaphysical and anything beyond, the concept of spiritual. So he's taken all the four elements of cause and brought them simply within the material purview. But what he's missing is that the reason that there's a formal cause or there's a shape is because there's the original shape that's created by the internal potency. Right? And that there's the ultimate cause means that you're ultimately to get to, not just ultimately the house is here so that I can live in it, but to be God conscious. So then that's the ultimate or absolute. Right? Then you have the ingredients of the material world, and then you have the person who operates it. Right? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So those two are the reflection of the other. That there's the original of the Lord and his potency. Mm-hmm. Right? And then here we're trying to be the Lord, and then there's the potency we use, which is the external. But the Lord and the internal potency, and the jiva and the external potency. Right, so he's not catching this distinction between matter and spirit, but all those four function within there because you have your ultimate cause, but it's not actually an ultimate cause, so it's not properly called ultimate. You know, but its ultimate means as far as whatever it is you're taking is ultimate. But you know what I'm saying? So it can be used within purely material, but we'll use it within the spiritual. So the order then will change. Our formal we'll put on the spiritual side. There is the form here. Right? So in other words, you bring all those down into the material. So you're just saying, I'm doing this because of this purpose. And the material nature is there, the ingredients, and they will be turned into a form. Right? And I'm going to do that. So I'm the efficient cause because I'm getting it done. Does that make sense? So all it is that they brought those two down to here and connect it with yourself. Right? I'm the efficient and the ultimate, and the material is the, you know, the ingredient and the formal. They don't understand the formal and the ultimate actually go on the spiritual side. Right? They're being misused materially. Does that make sense? Right? 'Cause this will come up more.
Maharaj,
yes.
Plato, his guru, he identified the ideal world, right, with ideal shapes. And that was, I sort of dropped that idea, right?
From what I understand is that he was even bringing it down to something that ideal here, based on something beyond, but more something you can view. While Socrates was, you don't worry so much what's here, because what's beyond is what's important. You know, so it's just each is coming down. So unfortunately, you know, Aristotle is taken as the, you know, kind of like the father of Western philosophy, which basically you could say he is.
but it's actually Socrates should have been. But they killed him because they didn't like his philosophy. Yes?
I was reading Bhaktivinoda Thakur, where he mentions a similar concept. He says that spirit is the dictionary of matter. And yes. So what I understood that to mean is that the all matter exists in an abstract form, like in a dictionary you have that idea. And then out in the world it's actually used, but the actual concept is eternally existing in the spiritual realm.
Yes.
And here we find the temporary manifestation.
Yes, yes. He said, like, in the spiritual world, there's real cooking.
Yeah.
You know, because you're cooking for Krishna, so all the elements are there. So the reflected form here, you get the best effect out of this illusory cooking if you follow the closest to the reflection of the original. But it only becomes real when you cook for Krishna. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's why the pious is always recommended. That's why he was saying, Vaishnav Das was saying, then you morally follow. Because in other words, you're pious. You follow all the things that are appropriate for the culture. Because that's the best form. So the techniques, the cooking is spiritual, the techniques you'd use here. Right? Then, but the point is there they do it for Krishna. They're doing it for Krishna, those are the best techniques. So you want to do it here for Krishna. And since you want to do it for Krishna, you use the best techniques. So it's the same. You could use lesser techniques. You know, the important is that it's done for Krishna. Is that some sense? Okay. So in Srimad Bhagavatam 6.9.42, O Lord, as the small sparks of a fire cannot possibly perform the actions of the whole fire, we sparks of your lordship cannot inform you of the necessities of our lives. You are the complete whole. Therefore, of what do we need to inform you? You know everything because you are the original cause of the cosmic manifestation, the maintainer and the annihilator of the entire universal creation. You always engage in your pastimes with your spiritual and material energies, for you are the controller of all these varied energies. You exist within all living entities, within the cosmic manifestation, and also beyond them. You exist internally as Parabrahman, and externally as the ingredients of the material creation. Therefore, although manifested in various stages, at different times and places, and in different bodies, you, the personality of Godhead, are the original cause of all causes. Indeed, you are the original element. You are the witness of all activities. And because you are as great as the sky, you are never touched by any of them. You are the witness of everything as Parabrahman and Paramatma. O Supreme Personality of Godhead, nothing is unknown to you. So it manifests in different stages. So the different bodies and that's your formal. Then the original cause of all causes. Then that's the original. You are the original element, so he's the elements themselves, and you're witness to all activities, because the activities then are what the jivas are doing. Like that. So, does that make sense? So then all four of those are mentioned. As Upadana, the Lord is the giver of the ingredients of creation. Right? Upadana means what are your ingredients. Like when you're doing puja, Upadana means the stage in the puja where you collect all the paraphernalia, all the ingredients. You get all the different lamps and plates and flowers and boga and clothes and like that. So that's Upadana. As Upadana, the Lord is the giver of the ingredients of creation. As Svarupena, Pradana Rupena, all material forms emanate from his eternal personal spiritual form. Like from his spiritual form, the primary creation then gives the blueprint of how they'll work here. Though that blueprint is based on the spiritual world. Right, you know, what is the eternal element? But you have a few more ingredients, varieties here that aren't necessarily so necessary there. Like, you don't need some mosquitoes in the spiritual world. But you need them here. Right? Imagine, if there are no mosquitoes, no flies, you know, so many of these things, you might think it's a great place. Right? So, therefore, the mosquitoes are, you know, helping so much in your spiritual realization. Because without them, then you wouldn't be thinking, I wish I wasn't my body. Right?
as nimitta yamana. He is the efficient cause, right? Because he is the time, the moment, how it's working. Because as Parabrahman, everything's there in the masculine feminine principle dynamically working. Then that's what makes everything function in the moment. So the living entity, even as the efficient cause, it's only because he's claiming to be. I claim I'm the doer, but I'm not actually. All I'm doing is assisting in Krishna as Parabrahman is the efficient cause. Right? Because actually Krishna's potencies, that's what's getting everything done. But because I'm involved, I'll say I did it. When actually we didn't. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's like the parents arranging something like this, and the, you know, the kid is there, small child, so they pick him up and he pushes a button or something and then it all happens. So the child thinks I did it. Okay. Right? But in reality they didn't. But it's still, it's fun. You know, that's the part. You know, so that's what I said before. So Krishna creates the world because the living entities want to be the controller. So then he arranges it so they can look as if they are, but in actuality. Or, you know, if we were the controller, you think somebody would have already worked it out by now, right? You know? Yeah. There'd be a proper manual how to be the controller of the universe. You know, and how to deal with all the other controllers of the universe. Yeah, you know.
Disagree.
That's volume two. Yeah. And as Arta Visesha, he manifests the special necessity or purpose of every living entity. Understanding Krishna in these ways liberates one from illusion. In Bhagavatam 11.9.21 is stated. So in other words, he's all these things because we're in the illusion that, no, the ingredients are mine, right? All the forms in that are, you know, unique in themselves, nothing to do with the Lord. You know, the effective ways to get things done, I'm coming up with that. It has nothing to do with the Lord. And the actual purpose of myself and all those endeavors, you know, I have my own idea when it's actually, no, it's the Lord. Right? So if one understands that, then that means everything you're dealing with, right? The situation, what you can, the situation can transform into, the endeavor you have to make, and the goal. All those things are connected with the Lord. What's there is Krishna's. What you transform it into is something for Krishna. Your purpose of doing that is to please Krishna. And you're simply assisting in that process. Right? Like that. Then it makes it very clear. But these are the four places where we think I'm the controller and enjoyer. So that's why they're broken down so much. Because this is where we make the mistake. We don't make the mistake somewhere else. Right. Get that. Okay, Bhagavatam 11.9.21. Just as from within, in himself, the spider expands thread through his mouth, plays with it for some time, and eventually swallows it. Similarly, the Supreme Personality of Godhead expands his personal potency from within himself. Thus, the Lord displays the network of cosmic manifestation, utilizes it according to his purpose, and eventually withdraws it completely within itself. But so his point is this: the spider, it puts out a net and it drops down, but it can also go back up it. It's not that it goes up and it sits there and has to wind it up and it's got all these, you know, sitting on its shoulder and this and that, and it's, you know, it just disappears back into itself. So the thread comes out and the thread can go back. So in the same way as the Lord creates the material world and then can pull it all back in. So that means all the four ingredients are Krishna. Just we can take part as assistants in the process. That's the... Does this make sense? How these analytical things, they're very practical, because this is where we make the mistake, isn't this? Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 2.9.28, by the inconceivable energy of the Lord, every creative element has its own potencies, known as the potency of the element, potency of knowledge, and potency of different actions and reactions. Right? It has inherent potencies. Means you have, there's knowledge by which those potencies can be used, and then there's the the potency by which, by this action, you get a reaction. Yes.
It's Kriya Shakti, Jnana Shakti, and Nitya Shakti.
Oh, okay. He uses the words later, or are you just...
Well, 2928, what do you... chapter review. I mean, chapter 12.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Kriya?
Is the actions and reactions.
Okay. Then you have Jnana is the knowledge.
Yeah.
And Icha.
And Phala Shakti, or Icha Shakti.
Icha. Okay.
Or it's also considered the Sandini.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So Sandini, Sambit, and Ladini, basically. This, reflections, or the active ingredients, I guess, within those.
We wouldn't have gone over this in Chaitanya Shikshama.
Of course. But of course, you'll be including that in there. Of course, okay.
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, I'm sticking to 12 years because that's a cycle of Brihaspatis, Jupiter, unless you want to expand it to 16 or something.
I don't have any plans.
Oh, okay. By a combination of such the potential energies of the Lord, there is the manifestation of creation, maintenance, and annihilation in due course of time and by different agents like Brahma, Vishnu, and Maheshwara. Brahma creates, Vishnu maintains, and Lord Shiva destroys. But all such agents and creative energies are emanations from the Lord, and as such there is nothing except the Lord, or the one supreme source of different diversities. See, we emphasize the non-difference, but at the same time it is different. Right? While these other schools, they'll, you know, the element that is non-different from him, I mean it is different from him, they'll emphasize that more. So then he gets left out of it, basically. The Lord doesn't become so much part of the picture. The exact example is the spider and spider's web. The web is created by the spider. It is maintained by the spider. And as soon as the spider likes, the whole thing is wound up within the spider. The spider is covered within the web. If an insignificant spider is so powerful as to act according to its will, why can't the Supreme Being act by his supreme will in the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the cosmic manifestations? By the grace of the Lord, a devotee like Brahma, or one in his chain of disciplic succession, can understand the almighty personality of Godhead, eternally engaged in his transcendental pastimes in the region of different energies. Okay. So that takes us back to page 5, right? Last sentence. And God is also the preserver, as he causes the atoms to hold together and continue their existence in a particular order that maintains the physical universe, right? So here he's only worried that they're held together, right? Vaisheshika is more worried about them not being held together, right? God is also the destroyer of the universe because he lets loose the forces of destruction when the energies of the mortal world require it. God is one, infinite, and eternal, and the universe of space and time, of mind and soul, does not limit him. God is said to possess six perfections: infinite glory, absolute sovereignty, unqualified virtue, supreme beauty, perfect knowledge, and complete detachment. Interesting when you put it into these terms. Mm-hmm. Then it takes on the more how you used to hearing him from religions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, absolute sovereignty, unqualified virtue. Yeah. So you can see these people, religions appreciate different aspects, but it's not complete. Mm-hmm. Right? That's Bhaktivinoda Thakur's point that's being brought out again and again, is that it's not that points that they're making aren't true, it's not complete. Mm-hmm. But unless it's complete, where's the conclusion? If you don't have the conclusion, how do you actually function? Yes?
I just want to confirm, if I understand correctly, Nyaya philosophy acknowledges 3 out of the 4 types of causes, or attributes those to God, all of them except the material cause. That he's kind of coexisting with matter. He never created it in the first place.
No, it mentions he creates it.
No, actually,
no?
He's using it.
Yeah, he's using it.
He's coexisting.
Oh, coexisting. Okay. So then, yeah. It's not exactly him then.
No.
the independent entity.
He just kind of woke up one day and it was there.
Since it's there, might as well do something with it. Hey. Yeah.
But is there any reason why Nyaya philosophy would deny that one element or aspect?
Maybe because then you'd have to get into a whole thing of why things don't go so well or something.
Yeah.
Well, see, they're trying to means the element that he's different from it, but they don't understand the sameness. So they don't. There's no distinction because there's no superior energy that this is a reflection of. So they don't have the internal potency means or the srup shakti, the chit shakti. That's everything. And then from that you have these three manifestations of internal, external, and jiva. So those lacking, then you'd naturally come up. So it's there. But he's not. And so jivas and the material energy is being acknowledged, but the spiritual is not.
Right.
So then that, so it doesn't, after elevating oneself, it doesn't place you in the spiritual world. Right? Probably ideally Brahman, but not anything beyond that. Is that okay?
Yeah, because I guess that would mean he's kind of the primeval cause existing outside of spirit.
Yeah.
And that would imply that there's actually a spiritual destination to go to, like an abode.
Yeah, there would, but at the same time as it's not discussed, so nobody thinks about it.
Yeah.
You know, just like in your world religions, God is there, you know, and there's the idea that, you know, people once walked with God. But after getting the boot from the garden, then going back, they want to go back. It means that it's funny, is the garden, they won't necessarily go there, the garden will descend. But when it descends, somehow, I guess it descends and doesn't descend with God. So there's just, we get the facility. So what they're missing is the niceness of being in the garden, not the niceness of interaction with God. So even there, even though there's so much talk about God, ultimately it's not about interacting with God. It's just being good and nice, because then he's the one that authorizes. Because he, like the saying here, he creates, he does all these things. But you want it, you want the nice facilities. And you don't want them temporarily, you want them eternal. You know, so it's kind of like a, has the element of karma mimamsa, but without having to change bodies. You know, like that. So it's a combination of the impersonal with the karma mimamsa.
Right.
You know, it's you get these funny. Okay, so I'll end here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki
jai,
samaveta bhaktivrinda ki
jai.
Go with it. Hare Krishna. One thing, G, on the numbering here to make it more clear, for also the element of the six systems, I would just have introduction and then put nyayas 1, 2, 3, 4 like that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Because
then when it gets to, because this can just have introduction.
You kind of,
and then when you get to here, then you see 1 nyaya. Otherwise it's 2, or what's the other philosophy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would just say like that.
Okay. I was thinking about this, but I'm not sure I didn't change the original layout.
Okay. Yeah, no, I would, but I'd do that and make it more clear. Also, at some point, do you take these, you know, in Sambandhavide and Prayoja and the subsections here, they have one place where you just kind of see them all in just like single lines or something, so that you have an understanding?
I didn't do this, but you want to have it as like an outline?
Yeah, just an outline, so you just know that his concept of God, you know, just like in one sentence, you know, the concept of Jesus, the concept of the concept, like that.
Do it maybe at the end of each school.
Okay.